Bien, buenas tardes, señor consejero de la Presidencia, Administraciones Públicas y Justicia, profesor Joseph Weiler, autoridades, señoras y señores. Como director de la Escuela Gallega de Administración Pública, constituye para mí un verdadero honor y un placer volver a tener en esta institución a una personalidad de la categoría del profesor Joseph Weiler. Licenciado en las universidades de Sussex y de Cambridge, es doctor honoris causa por varias universidades y su currículum extenso lo tienen ustedes en la documentación que hemos distribuido, documentación que consta de la conferencia en inglés, en gallego y en castellano. Disponen de aparatos para traducción simultánea a través de la sintonización del canal número 3. Pues bien, el profesor Weiler, que ya nos honró con su presencia en mayo del 2010 con la conferencia Valores y Virtudes de la Integración Europea, lo que podemos aprender de Aristóteles, Aquino y Maimónides, vuelve otra vez a este centro, por lo cual estamos sumamente agradecidos. Y en efecto, en estos momentos de crisis económica e institucional que vive el mundo y, como no, Europa, otra vez volvemos la mirada hacia Europa para que decisiones que son necesarias tomar terminen con la parálisis del proceso de integración europea y sean un motor para salir de ella. Ante todos estos retos, estamos seguros que las palabras del profesor Weiler serán de nuevo guía de perplejos, como fueron en su día las de nuestro compatriota cordobés Maimónides, que a la luz de su Talmud ofreció a la eternidad una linterna que también en nuestros días alumbra nuestro camino. En todos sus trabajos, dice el profesor Rubio Llorente, presidente actual del Consejo de Estado y catedrático de Derecho Constitucional, en el prólogo al libro del profesor Weiler, Una Europa Cristiana, en todos los trabajos del profesor Weiler, dice, hay sobre todo dos rasgos que lo singularizan y que lo dotan, a su juicio, de un atractivo especial. Por un lado, la originalidad de la perspectiva desde la que se aborda el estudio de la integración y se intenta teorizarla, y por otro, la admirable fuerza con la que el profesor Weiler expone sus ideas. Weiler es uno de los grandes expertos de la integración europea, un formidable jurista capaz de hacer análisis agudos y construcciones dogmáticas sólidas y de ofrecer soluciones eficaces, que es lo más importante, para los problemas que la práctica diaria nos plantea. Pero si en este terreno hay otros autores también distinguidos, es difícil encontrar alguien que pueda parangonarse con él en lo que toca a esos dos rasgos que he destacado. En él, continúa el profesor Rubio Llorente, es claramente perceptible un constante esfuerzo por construir una teoría normativa de la integración europea, a partir todo ello de su espíritu, del impulso profundo que ha llevado a los europeos a unirse políticamente. Impulso que ha de comprenderse como una voluntad de unidad asentada sobre la conciencia de participar de una misma identidad, de constituir un demos, de formar parte de una comunidad ética diferenciada en el conjunto de la humanidad. Europa es, nos dice Weiler, un proyecto de comunidad política mejor, de una sociedad mejor, una fórmula que hace pensar en la célebre definición orteguiana de nación. Pues bien, uno de los grandes méritos que tiene el profesor Weiler es el de haber tenido la lucidez necesaria para percibir esta carencia teórica de la integración europea y la audacia bastante para denunciarla e intentar remediarla, adentrándose en lo que no es solo terra incógnita, sino más bien un campo minado. y todo ello con su admirable capacidad expresiva, como luego tendrán la oportunidad de apreciar. Non abbiate paura, no tengamos miedo. Miremos como Jano hacia atrás para mejor poder comprender y mirar hacia adelante como perplejos que necesitamos guía otra vez de nuestros mayores. Muchas gracias, profesor Weiler, por venir una vez más a esta escuela, por honrarnos con su presencia y con su docta capacidad intelectual. Gracias por hablarnos desde su autoridad intelectual de Europa, de una Europa que respeta por igual, de forma plena y completa, a todos sus ciudadanos, una Europa que, celebrando la herencia noble de la Ilustración humanista, reconoce las herencias griega, latina y cristiana como elementos centrales en el desarrollo de su propia civilización. Pero no soy yo el que debe dar la conferencia, ni a mí han venido a escucharme ustedes. Agradezco sumamente la respuesta a esta llamada. Muchas gracias por dedicar parte de su valiosísimo tiempo para venir al EGAP, y como director de la misma les digo muchas gracias por su presencia y espero que sea de utilidad las palabras que vamos a escuchar, estoy seguro que sí, del profesor Weiler. Nada más y muchas gracias.
Muy bien, pues muy brevemente, señor director de la Escuela Galega de Administración Pública, profesor Joseph Weiler, señores y señores, muy buenas tardes a todos. Simplemente decir, como consejero de Presidencia, Administraciones Públicas y Justicia, que es para mi honor darle de nuevo, como decía Pablo Feroa, la bienvenida a nuestra tierra al profesor Weiler. Y además un agradecimiento que es doble. Primero, por la propia altura y calidad del conferenciante. Y segundo, también porque el tema que va a tratar, que nos va a explicar, es sin duda decisivo. Siempre lo es y mucho más en estos momentos tan delicados. Yo creo que sobre lo primero, sobre el prestigio de nuestro invitado, señalar brevemente que se trata de un experto constitucionalista que está considerado como uno de los principales estudiosos sobre el proceso de integración europea, la globalización y la democracia. En la actualidad es catedrático y director del Centro Jean Monnet para la Justicia y el Derecho Económico Regional e Internacional de la Universidad de Nueva York. Ocupó anteriormente una cátedra en la Facultad de Derecho de Michigan y ostentó las cátedras Manley Jackson y Jean Monnet de la Facultad de Derecho de Harvard. Además, fue profesor del Colegio de Europa en Brujas y ocupado múltiples y diversos cargos dentro de la propia Organización de la Unión Europea. El currículum del profesor Weiler, por tanto, deja bien claro cuál es el tema y la trascendencia del tema del que hoy viene a hablarnos. Como en la última ocasión que nos visitó en el EGAP, como refería el director, cuando habló de los valores y virtudes de la integración europea, rescatando las raíces más profundas de la unión de nuestro viejo continente, hoy el profesor viene a ilustrarnos sobre el ADN político y legal de la Unión y su relación con la actual crisis europea. Yo creo que a veces hay una coincidencia más amplia entre todos los estudiosos, entre la clase política y, en general, entre toda la sociedad, de que una parte muy considerable y, sin duda, la fundamental de los problemas y de los retos políticos y económicos que están afectando durante estos últimos años y, especialmente, en el momento actual Europa, están muy directamente conectados con las deficiencias que puede arrojar el nivel de gobierno europeo, donde a veces se toman decisiones económicas que no siempre están suficientemente coordinadas con las de todos y cada uno de los Estados miembros. Las reflexiones, por tanto, del profesor Weiler nos resultan imprescindibles para poder comprender, poder arrojar más luz sobre lo que está ocurriendo en estos momentos y, sobre todo, creo yo, sobre lo que va a ocurrir de ahora en adelante. El profesor defiende la tesis de que la organización democrática no formaba parte originalmente de ese ADN de la integración europea, por lo menos en su génesis, y esto puede explicar por menos en parte la actual situación de crisis. Señala nuestro invitado como causas de estas circunstancias un crónico de déficit democrático, la creciente indiferencia de los ciudadanos y la incapacidad al final de Europa para traducir su poder económico en poder político. Desde luego, lo que es cada vez más evidente es que gran parte de la salida de nuestros actuales problemas sigue estando en Europa, tiene que estar en Europa. Y, por lo tanto, para Galicia, desde luego, el proyecto europeo fue imprescindible, contribuyó, sin duda, a la mejora de todo lo que es importante para nosotros y, desde luego, tiene que seguir siéndolo en el futuro. Y de ahí el empeño del Gobierno gallego y creo que de toda Galicia en seguir siendo beneficiarios de las ayudas europeas y en reivindicar eso que hemos dado en llamar un aterrizaje suave respecto a la percepción de fondos europeos. Pero más allá de nuestro problema, que nos tiene que ocupar aquí en primer lugar, de nuestras circunstancias, de nuestra relación con Europa, todo lo que le debemos y todo lo que esperamos de ella, desde luego estoy seguro que como formamos parte de Europa, también formamos parte de ese problema político europeo de mucha mayor envergadura, que va a ser sin duda un reto fundamental a abordar en los próximos años, si queremos, y creo que lo queremos todos, que el gobierno económico de nuestro continente no siga sujeto a estos vaivenes. Por lo tanto, confiamos en que las reflexiones y lo que nos va a exponer el profesor Weiler pueda ayudarnos a afrontarlo a todos con más sabiduría. Profesor Weiler, tiene usted la palabra.
Thank you. I'm always so sad my mother is not here at the beginning of these talks. She is 92, I think she would enjoy this. I have a simple thesis. If we have a monetary union, and the monetary union is in crisis, things are not going very well, and that happens. It's cyclical in market economies. Then you need a much higher degree of fiscal union to be able to resolve the problems. I think that's a commonplace. When the monetary union was discussed, those who were opposed to it said, if there will be an asymmetric crisis, will you have the fiscal tools to address it? So the problem we are facing is not rooted in not knowing what needs to be done. On the one hand, there should be what fiscal union implies, massive transfer of resources in the asymmetric situation from rich economies to poor economies, in the same way that if there is a crisis in Louisiana, it will be tax money from California which will step in and it will be understood. Or if there's a crisis in Hamburg, it will be tax money from Munich which will be used to help them. That's the nature of a fiscal union. So the problem is not the tools. The problem is that the social reality that is needed to undergird a fiscal union is not here. In other words, as we can see, we should not point a finger at Merkel. Merkel is listening to her people. And they are saying, why should we take responsibility for what is happening in Greece? We are the ants which worked all the summer, and they are the grasshoppers who danced all the summer. And why should we now take responsibility for their problems? I'm not saying if they're right or wrong. I'm describing an empirical reality. That's how they feel. And when you feel that way, that's what the people in Finland feel, that's what the people in the Netherlands feel, and maybe others who do not speak so clearly. But when you have that kind of social reality, it's very difficult, or it's much more difficult, to adopt the political instruments that are needed, which is a far greater level of fiscal discipline and the transfer that of resources which is implied in a fiscal union. What I'm going to do in my lecture today is to try and explain why we don't have the kind of social reality that is necessary for the tools that just about everybody knows need to be adopted. That's what I'm going to try and explain. So it doesn't put me in a good position because It doesn't put me in a good position because I'm in the position of the first Isaiah, not the second Isaiah. I'm coming to say, you did this and this and this, and therefore now you're going to suffer. That's the first Isaiah, chapters 1 to 40, instead of the second Isaiah who promises a wonderful future. But that's what I'm going to try and do today. And it is a story that is not often told. So let's forget for a minute. We can come back to it at the end. Greece and Portugal and Italy. You note I'm not mentioning Spain. And think about what I consider deeper roots of the current crisis. And the deeper roots of the current crisis are legitimacy roots. In other words, that the European Union does not have the kind of legitimacy to really act decisively in the manner which the crisis requires. How do we attain legitimacy, political legitimacy? The first important, fundamental type of legitimacy is process legitimacy. It's what we call, in other words, democracy. Democracy is a form of process legitimacy. It creates a solidarity because people understand that government is acting on behalf of the people and for the people. And it consolidates the sense of peoplehood because you come together in the democratic process. So now it is very boring, but it has to be said and it has to be repeated. Notwithstanding Lisbon, I mean the Lisbon Treaty, and notwithstanding all other attempts and rhetoric, Europe continues to suffer from a profound democracy deficit. And I'm going to explain, and therefore does not enjoy process legitimacy. It suffers from a profound democratic deficit, and therefore does not enjoy process legitimacy. In what sense does Europe continue to suffer from a democratic deficit? In three fundamental, primitive senses. Principle number one of democracy is accountability. I don't like the government of Zapatero, I can throw them out. The English have a nice expression for it. In democracy, there is the ability to throw the scoundrels out, to change the government, to hold political actors accountable politically, not personally, if somebody puts their hand in the money box and steals money. That we have, but politically. You promise something, you did not perform, we throw you out of power. Somebody else is going to try. And that ability of the people to hold their politicians accountable is what makes the politicians accountable, because they know there is a day of reckoning. Europe has governance. It does not have government in the same sense we have in a member state. Now, I understand that the European Union is not a state, and we cannot expected to behave and to have the exact mechanisms and institutions that a state has. It's not a state, and most people in Europe do not want it to be a state. But even though it's not a state, it exercises a huge amount of governance over entire areas of our public life. And we all live in a political culture in which we say, if there is an exercise of public power, it has to be legitimated democratically. And what I'm doing now is articulating what are the most fundamental, primordial, primitive principles of democracy. And the first is accountability. In Europe, we cannot throw the scoundrels out. There's no day in the calendar that if enough people go and vote in a certain way, they can have a new government. It doesn't exist. It's a structural problem of Europe. It's not that somebody is cheating. It's not that somebody is corrupt. That is how we constructed the European Union. Europe has had failures. Copenhagen global warming was a failure. Lisbon agenda was a failure. Can anybody in this room, can anybody anywhere, give me one example where somebody was held politically accountable for the failures of Europe? It doesn't exist. Again, not because of corruption, because of the way we built the Union. Governance without government, and therefore nobody is politically accountable. That's the first aspect of this democracy deficit. The second aspect is a political deficit. Let me explain. At the heart of democracy, there is politics, ideology. You choose between the left or the right. You choose between the center-left or the center-right. Parties have a political content. They say, vote for me because I'm social democrat. Vote for me because I'm liberal. Vote for me because I'm conservative or Christian democrat. They present a program. And choice between different programs is what informs democracy. Democracy without politics is no democracy. Because democracy with no politics means democracy with no choices. If there are no choices, how can you have democracy? Now let's think about it. We have the Commission, that wonderful, I say this with no cynicism, original institution of the European Union. The Commission is committed not to be political. Barroso cannot go there and say, I am center-right or I am center-left, and therefore I am going to push the Commission according to my politics. Barroso, when he's appointed as president of the Commission, appropriately said, you can forget about my politics. I will serve Europe as a whole. And so it is with every commissioner. You, ladies and gentlemen, especially those of you closer to my age, will remember that when the large member states had two commissioners, not one, it was the convention that you would appoint one from the right and one from the left, because the commission had to be politically neutral, non-political. The Council of Ministers and the European Council also has to be neutral. Why? Politics is not bon ton. Zapatero cannot go there and say, well, I'm a socialist and therefore I push Europe in this direction, because somebody would say, forget it, you're not in Madrid, you're in Brussels now. You have somebody coming from a socialist country, somebody coming from a conservative country. So in Brussels, they all become pragmatic. It is not bon ton to plead party politics. That's not being European. But I repeat, without politics, there can be no democracy. Politics without politics is not democracy. It's philosopher kings. Very nice, but not democracy. So the political deficit is the second aspect of our democracy deficit. And the third aspect is the primitive, primordial principle of representation. When you go every 4 years, every 5 years, if there's a crisis, it can be every 3 years, depending on what system you live in. But now I'm talking about 27 democracies, the ones we have in Europe. And enough people in the electoral vote for the legislature, what the Italians say, the legislative. If enough people vote for the right, we will expect that the policies of Italy will be center-right. If enough people vote left, we will expect that the politics of Italy will be center-left. It does make a difference in this country, in Spain, if there is a center-left majority in parliament in Madrid or if there's a center-right. It doesn't make sometimes a huge difference, but it does make a difference in taxation, in redistribution, in foreign policy, in a whole range of issues. Now you tell me, when we vote for the European Parliament, and there might be a socialist majority in the European Parliament, or a Christian Democrat, a center-right majority in the European Parliament, does it make any difference to the policies adopted by Europe? The answer is, it does not. It does not. I can explain it in a different way. Nothing a member of the European Parliament does, says, votes, will determine whether he or she will be re-elected at the next election. That very brutal, I like it, principle of democracy, the principle of re-election, does not operate in Europe. If you are going to be elected or not elected the next time to the European Parliament depends on what the Secretary General of your party does. Did he put you on the list or did he not put you on the list? And then it depends on the politics of your own country, but absolutely not on what you did in Strasbourg and in Brussels as a member of the European Parliament. So the third principle, basic, primitive, which we find in all our member state principle of democracy, does not exist in Europe. Accountability, representation, and politics. So it's not surprising that I speak about a profound democracy deficit. I want to talk now about the second crisis, or the second manifestation of the legitimacy crisis. It's not just that there is no process legitimacy. We can see a social phenomenon, at best indifference, and at worst hostility. And the manifestations of this, for example, it's for the first time now become mainstream politics in Europe that you can gain votes by being anti-European. It used to be, except in England, it used to be, is England in Europe? I'm just teasing. Bad joke, I apologize. But it used to be a phenomenon of fringe parties on the far left and the far right. But now it's not fringe parties. Now it's part of normal politics in many member states that to have a kind of skeptical or Eurosceptical approach and even more a hostility to Europe, we see that in Holland, we see that in Finland, we see that in Germany, we see that in many other member states, has become mainstream, not peripheral. But I'll give you a much sharper example. I remember when I was young and beautiful, the first book I wrote was on the European Parliament. And I lamented in the book why there was such a low turnout to elections, direct elections to the European Parliament, which started in 1979. And then, with the confidence of a young man, 30 years ago. What age do you stop being young? With the confidence of a young man, I was 30 or something, I said, the European Parliament has no power. So why should people vote for it? Why should people go and vote for a body that has no power? You wait, I wrote. The more power you give to the European Parliament, the greater the turnout in elections will become. Logic, right? It's one of the many things I've been wrong in my life. The list of things that I've been wrong is much longer than the list of things I've been right. The European Parliament today is a co-legislature with the Council of Ministers. There's very little in the European Union that can happen without the agreement of the European Parliament. Over the last 30 years, from 1979, with every intergovernmental conference, Nice, well, Maastricht and Amsterdam and Nice and Lisbon, the European Parliament got more power. And with every elections to the European Parliament, less and less people have gone to vote. For the whole of Europe, it's less than 45% now. If we took out the countries where it's obligatory to vote, it would be less than 40%. In some countries, it's 20%, 30%. Now, don't tell me, but in America, it's also only 50%. First of all, who said that America is such a great democracy? And secondly, we should not compare the turnout to elections in the United States. We should compare the turnout to the European Parliament to the turnout to elections to the legislature in Madrid, in Berlin, in London, in Paris, in Rome. You with me? To our national elections. And there the difference is huge. When there are elections in Madrid, everybody goes and votes, 60, 70, 80%. When there are elections to the European Parliament, even though it has all these powers, less and less people go to vote. So you see, there is an increasing legitimacy crisis, at least in difference. Why should I vote? It doesn't matter. What can Europe do? And even hostility, this Europe is doing, is not serving me well. That is new. That we did not have 15 years ago. We did not have 20 years ago. Now, how did we get there? Because this is the question you should ask me. You know, once I was on giving a lecture like this in Berlin on national television, and my cell phone began to ring. First of all, it was a horrible ring. Secondly, I couldn't find it. It was the second most embarrassing moment in my life. Okay, so you should be asking me, Professor Weiler, the democracy deficit is not new. The democracy deficit has been with us from the beginning of the European Union. But the legitimacy crisis is new. So why didn't we have a legitimacy crisis 15 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, if we had a democracy deficit all these years? That's what I'm going to explain to you. I'm going to explain to you why we didn't have a legitimacy crisis in the 50s, when the democracy deficit was even greater, in the 60s, when the democracy deficit was even greater, in the 70s, and why we are having it now. So that's what I'm going to explain now. Because There are two other mechanisms of legitimacy apart from process legitimacy. The second mechanism, I don't like it, but it works. The Romans called it bread and circus. It's result legitimacy. When you gain legitimacy not by how you do it, but the results that you achieve. So if you have economic prosperity, if you have growth, if you have employment, if you have success, even though you are managing to achieve these things, avoiding the basic principles of democratic process, it's legitimating because results speak. The best way to legitimate a war is to win it. If you win the war, nobody asks you, why did you go to war? It's only when you lose the war that people say, who allowed you to go, why did you go, etc. So result legitimacy has been with us since the Roman Empire. Give them bread, give them circus, they will be happy. We will be legitimate. And it still operates today. And you can find in official documents of the Union people saying the legitimacy of the Commission is determined by the results achieved. So a reason for the enduring legitimacy, despite the democratic deficit that is with us, is that Europe was successful. Europe was tremendously successful. It was successful in two fundamental areas. First of all, it did the most important thing it promised to do. It did with huge success, which was to bring about a historical reconciliation between France and Germany. If you look, take 1950, when the Schuman Declaration is announced, and you look 200 years before that, in every generation, the French and the Germans fought each other. It's astonishing. This period, since the end of the World War II, is the longest period of peace in Western Europe in its history. And a big measure of that, not the only measure, the Cold War helped. Even the dreaded Americans helped. But a very big part of that success was thanks to European integration. So it delivered that success. And that success legitimates. And the second thing, it really allowed remarkable reconstruction after the Second World War. The common marketplace is a success. The common marketplace is a success. I'm not talking European Union. I'm talking the free movement of goods, of services, of workers. It's been a big success. We have had sustained prosperity for several decades. You can't argue with success. And therefore, when you would talk about democracy deficit, me, the Old Testament prophet, democracy, democracy, they would say, leave us alone, look at the results. Now I want to talk about something that is not discussed. This is an innovation of this lecture. And it's hugely important. Why is it hugely important? Because again, you should ask me a question. You should say, Professor Weiler, result legitimacy could only explain from the 60s onwards, because we didn't have results in the 50s. We didn't have results in the early 60s. It takes time for those results to come. So what legitimated the Union in the 50s, in the 60s, before you could point to concrete results? And the third type of legitimacy we have, and not only in the European Union, we have it in the history of our countries, it's called messianic legitimacy, political messianism, from the word Messiah. What is political messianism? Political messianism is when a charismatic politician comes and says, forget about the process. And in fact, the results are going to come later. But follow me because I have a wonderful vision of the future. I will take you to a promised land. And in order to get to that promised land, that's the messianic, a new kingdom, you will have to make sacrifices. The history of Europe, if we look from the beginning of the 20th century, is legitimacy through political messianisms and process legitimacy. Political messianism, process legitimacy. The Europe that goes into the First World War, the German Empire, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, even the Brits, France, its very political legitimacy is strongly rooted in a political messianic vision. The grandeur of the state, the promise of our own importance, the emperor, the king, etc. That is political messianism. After the First World War, there's a turn to process legitimacy in all the new democracies after the First World War. In Germany and France, they collapse. And there's once again a turn to political messianism in Europe, in communism and in fascism. Communism and fascism are political messianic movements. And don't let's forget, they mobilized millions. You know, you go to Italy today, everybody in Italy was part of the resistance. Nobody supported Mussolini. All these people you see in the photographs, the millions shouting, il Duce, that's a Fata Morgana. No. Communism and fascism had a huge mobilizing power. That's the nature of political messianism. At the end of the Second World War, there was once again, not in this country, but in Western Europe, a turn to process legitimacy. Very radical democracy. France, Britain, Holland, they give up their empires. They're not interested in these stories of grandeur. The sun does not set on the British Empire, etc. Churchill is thrown out of office. It's democracy, it's social democracy. But now we come to our beloved Europe. And this is the story which we haven't noticed. All the member states of the European Union, the original six, the nine, the ten, they all turned away from political messianism as a form of legitimacy. But Europe, the Europe of Jean Monnet, is a political messianic project. Don't compare it for one second to fascism or communism. It's a noble political messianic, but it is political messianism. If you read, and we distributed the translation, if you read the language of the Schuman Declaration, you can see it. I will read it in English. This kind of bombastic messianic language. World peace cannot be safeguarded without making creative efforts. The contribution which an organized and living Europe can bring to civilization is indispensable. You hear the rhetoric? Our contribution to civilization. A first step in the federation of Europe which will change the destinies of the regions. This is all. A war between France and Germany becomes not merely unthinkable but materially impossible. This is a wonderful promised land which is being proposed. And it has huge mobilizing force. What you note in the messianic vision of Europe and in the construct that follows it, the word democracy does not appear once in the Schuman Declaration. The word human rights does not appear once in the Schuman Declaration. The word democracy does not appear in the Treaty of Paris. The word human rights does not appear in the Treaty of Paris, establishing the European communities. Not even in the Treaty of Rome, establishing the EEC, the first pillar. Why? Because a titolo giusto, a titre juste. We wanted to reach that promised land. And therefore, the basic structure of governance, which has not changed from then till this day, is a union of doers, commission executives, not with the member states, with the executive branches of the member states. It's a philosophy of let's go and do it because we're marching to the promised land. And it had huge mobilizing force. The promised land was so alluring that it had huge mobilizing force. Where did the legitimacy of Europe come before the results, despite the democracy deficit? From the promised land, from the political messianic vision of the future. We are going to a better place than we are today. Think of how it felt in Spain to join the European Union. How it felt in Portugal to join the European Union. How it felt in Greece. It was joining this club which promised a better future, which promised a better. It was that promise of a better future which made people so enthusiastic about the European Union. Now, let me say something about what happens to political messianism. Political messianism always fails. Why? Because if it succeeds, it fails, and if it fails, it fails. Why does it fail when it succeeds? For two reasons, or two sides of the same coin. Because the promised land is never as nice as the promise. Reality, marriage never turns out to be so happy as it felt when we were courting each other. It's the messiness of life. The promised land is full of problems. It's full of details. So on the one hand, we get there. And on the other hand, when we get there, the lights are not as shining. The sun is not so bright. The rain is not so in abundance. If you want a metaphoric expression, the Schuman Declaration is 800 words of inspiration. The Treaty of Lisbon is 150,000 words. That's reality. 150,000 words can never inspire you. They can just bore you. So the very success of political messianism embodies its failure. And when it succeeds, so we've reached it, but what's the next promise? Today, Europe does not have a political messianic project. What is the promise of Europe? We wanted to get its house in order. We wanted to solve our problems. But there's no longer this noble vision. I remember Mitterrand and Kohl going before the French people to persuade them to vote yes in the referendum in France on the Treaty of Maastricht. And these two aging politicians were saying, it's imperative that you vote for Europe, that you vote yes, because it's about the historical reconciliation of Germany and France. This is back in 1991. And most people below the age of 40 didn't know what they were talking about. Why didn't they know what they were talking about? Because Europe was so successful. And therefore, that aspect of its political messianic vision disappeared. It's successful. And indeed, the referendum on Maastricht was won by 1%. If 20,000 Frenchmen had voted the other way, Maastricht would have disappeared. And that was an illustration of the decline of the political messianism as a legitimacy factor. So now, we can come back to the present. Europe really has a legitimacy problem today because the political messianism which drove it at its roots is the victim of its own success. It's gone. When I speak to young students, 22, 23, 25-year-old, and I ask them, what's the dream of Europe? It's very difficult to articulate it. It's very difficult to articulate a dream. They say, no dream, I just want it to work. I like that answer. But you note the disappearance of the dream. And legitimacy from results is much more complicated today, because where are the results? We're in a huge crisis, so there's no more bread and there's no more circus. Or maybe there's no more bread and there is a circus. The circus of politicians running around in a circle and arguing with each other. But that's not the circus that mobilizes. And there's no process legitimacy because of the democratic deficit, which I explained at the beginning of my lecture. So the three foundations which sustained, which mobilized people for the idea of Europe, have weakened and disappeared, and maybe never existed. So now let's go back to this current crisis. Let's pretend that Spain is not in the picture. As I say, the solutions could be Eurobonds. But Eurobond is a form of everybody vouching for everybody else. And I mean everybody. So it's lending money in which the debt is owned by the Germans and the Greeks. That's what a Eurobond means. The debt is owned by the Germans and the Greeks. It's not a Greek debt, it's not a German debt, it's a debt owned by... You could raise quite a lot of money that way. But in order to succeed, the Germans have to agree that they want to own a debt together with the Greeks. Or you could have a more advanced fiscal union. Think the unthinkable. Even European tax. But even if you don't have a European tax, some form of fiscal union, which means the rich... There's a transfer of resources in an asymmetric crisis from the rich to the poor. But that means that the people who pay the tax have to be willing that that tax money will go to support the poor regions. Are you with me? Now let's be serious. We claim that we believe in democracy. So don't we expect Merkel and other prime ministers to listen to their people and ask them, do you want this or you don't want that? Sometimes we can be bold, and maybe that is the solution here. Europe has often been considered an elite construct. Let's do it regardless. That is also a possibility. If they had the political will, they could do it regardless. But we should feel very ambivalent about that. We should feel very ambivalent about taking a huge new step in the process of European integration when we cannot say that it has the full support, a popular support, not of the politicians at the top, but at popular Europe. And that I don't see. That could only happen if a class of European politician emerged which could A, offer a viable project to indeed increase democratic accountability in the European Union, B, hold out the promise of true concrete results, and C, offer a vision for the future which will have the mobilizing force that political messianism delivers. And then one would have the legitimacy to take that step, which we all know at a technical level one needs if we have a monetary union and we don't have a fiscal union. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.
Muchas gracias, profesor Weiler, por su magnífica conferencia, siempre llena de agradables sorpresas y razonamientos. Se abre ahora una fase de coloquio y yo les pido que participen en el mismo porque es la manera de complementar la conferencia del profesor Weiler, haciéndole hablar más todavía. Él no quiere hablar más, pero estoy seguro que lo hará con mucho gusto al contestar las preguntas.
Hola, buenas tardes a todos. Mi nombre es Alberto Méndez y soy socio fundador de una empresa de marketing online con sede en Vigo y en Madrid. Well, I would like to speak directly in English to Professor Weiler. Hi, Mr. Weiler. It was a privilege to listen this afternoon. And I would like to make you some questions about what you think about the future. I've been listening to you for the whole afternoon, and I know that you have been talking about the principal premises about what happened in Europe during the last century, the 20th century. But from my point of view, I think that we have an identity problem, understanding identity as a collective thing. I mean, long time ago, we were not like a union, European Union. We were 9 countries. Later, we were 15. Now we are 27. And I don't know how many countries we are going to be in the future. Who knows? But I think that we have an identity problem, because other countries like America or like China, I don't think that they have that problem. I don't mean that we have to make an Americanization of Europe, but I think that in the future we have to be competitive. And I don't feel like we competed all together against all these countries. So I would like to understand what you think about in 20, 30 countries about Europe, if we're going to be able to defend our rights and going to be able to compete with these huge countries, from the point of view that you are a global human, that you have been living in all these countries as a professor, and you was born in South Africa, and later you were born in Europe, like in UK and the Netherlands. Thank you very much.
I'm the wrong person to ask that. No, I'm not being facetious. I should ask you, because what will be the future of Europe depends on the peoples of Europe. So first of all, there's a bad tendency, and I discussed this in my last lecture 2 years ago. There's a bad tendency, in my view, in Europe to always say there's a problem and then to turn to the politician, so what is your solution? To turn to somebody else to come up with answers. And not to responsabilize oneself. So the future of Europe will depend on what the people of Europe want. Now, the signs are mixed. The signs are mixed. For example, on the one hand, for the most part, the signs are mixed. The European peoples rejected the Constitution. They rejected the Constitution. We don't like to talk about it. We tremendously capable when it comes to amnesia, to forgetting the bad. But the European people rejected the Constitution. And it was not just in France and in Netherlands. If the referendum in France and Netherlands had come earlier, there would have been a lot more opposition also in other countries. And if we had reached Poland and Britain and Czechoslovakia, etc., there would have been more votes. And even in Spain, where the referendum was a decisive yes, it was a very low turnout. It was such a low turnout that in Italy that would not have been considered a legitimate referendum. So it's not clear to me if the peoples of Europe are truly interested in a higher degree of European integration. I'm just not sure about that. And therefore, no matter what I think, what vision I would have for Europe, etc., I think listening to what public opinion, what different countries want, etc., is quite important. Because when you don't listen, that's when you get into some of the troubles we are now, that you run ahead with some projects, even when there is a disparity between the popular support and the elite commitment. And then when you run into trouble, suddenly you discover that you do not have the political capital to take the steps that are necessary. So one vision is to imagine a grand vision, a mobilizing force, a rebirth of Europe, a new commitment, etc., etc. I don't see that happening. But it might. I don't see where are the politicians to lead this. If I say this, but if I look around at the political landscape of Europe, where are the politicians that would have the force of personality, the charisma, to lead a major rebirth of the European dream? Sarkozy? Mrs. Merkel? Mr. Cameron? In this country, I don't see it. The second option is a more differentiated approach. It is now being discussed openly again. We already have a Europe de vitesse, two-speed. The euro is a Europe de vitesse. We have 17 countries in it and 10 countries out of it. So once again, the possibility of identifying certain projects and moving with certain projects with different configurations of different member states, etc., it's an architecture which should not be dismissed. All or nothing worked well when it was a Europe of 6 and a Europe of 9 and a Europe of 10. A Europe of 27 and in the near future 28, 29, you know, Croatia, Serbia, some other Balkan countries. Look what the little Finland can do to the collective will of 17 countries. So the vision of the whole all or nothing may have to be looked at again. Maybe one should be more pragmatic, more modest, and identify projects which could be done with different configurations of states, with different, not just de vitesse, but variable geometry. That is also a possibility that Europe might think of going ahead. On competitiveness, I think the common market, that is an asset which should not be given up. That is still the backbone of Europe, the common marketplace. And that is what ensures European competitiveness. It's the internal competitions between your firm in Madrid and a competing firm in Berlin or in Paris, etc., which makes you competitive. And if you're competitive within Europe, you will also be competitive in the global arena. So once again, if the idea is competitiveness, I'm just redimensioning downwards and saying you don't have to think, you don't have to have a messianic vision if what you're interested in is an economically competitive Europe which can compete with the Chinese and the Americans, etc. So, but again, I'm the wrong person to answer that question. The question has to be given from within the political process of Europe itself. And the mistake which has to be avoided is to move ahead with a project where there's too big a difference between popular support and elite leadership. That's where we find ourselves today. That's why our politicians are having difficulties in taking the necessary fiscal moves, because they don't feel that they have the support from their own people. And that's a serious matter because you and I believe in democracy.
Sí. Soy Beatriz Piñeiro. Creo que muchos de los problemas que está comentando es por lo que la sociedad en sí conoce de lo que es la Unión Europea, el Parlamento Europeo. Cuando tuve la oportunidad de estar este año en el Parlamento Europeo, conocerlo por dentro, y tuve la oportunidad de estar en una de las comisiones, me di cuenta que creo que estamos en una situación de desconocimiento de la sociedad. La sociedad no apoya lo que es la Unión Europea por desconocimiento, por todo lo que se puede hacer y lo que nos podemos aprovechar todos los europeos para el mercado común. No sé si usted opina lo mismo, pero la sensación como ciudadana de a pie, para mí fue un antes y un después el haber conocido el funcionamiento del Parlamento Europeo, de cómo se trabaja dentro. Creo que ahí están todos trabajando de una forma común, no con diferencias políticas, sino ahí se está trabajando, por lo menos en las comisiones, todos a un mismo nivel. Y yo tuve esa sensación de desconocimiento del resto de las personas que no tuvieron la oportunidad de ir. Yo no sé si desde la clase política tendrían que pararse más en poder comunicar a la gente lo que se hace y lo que se desarrolla en lo que es el Parlamento Europeo. Muchas gracias.
I hope I understood your question. You know that I have great admiration for the translators, but you know what they say about translation. It's like kissing through a handkerchief. So something is always lost. You and I will have to agree to disagree, because you presented as an attractive model the fact that you participated in workings of committees of the European Parliament and everybody was working together and there were no political differences, and wasn't that wonderful, all working for Europe, and you had a before and after experience. That is how I understood what you were saying through the translation. I find that horrible, and I tell you why I find that horrible. It's not because I like blood. It's because why should I vote for that parliament and even win the election if then it doesn't make a difference because all of them work together without political differences? If I go and mobilize and go from house to house and say vote Social Democrat or vote Christian Democrat and there's a majority in parliament, and then in the committee it's just everybody working together for this kind of technocratic thing, so why should I go and vote for the European Parliament? They're going to do what they want to do anyway. It looks as if my preference and my majority doesn't influence what is coming out. You describe the reality of the European Parliament. The difference between you and I is that you think that is wonderful because at some human level it's wonderful when people are not fighting, they're cooperating. But I think that politics is about contrasts. Politics is about choices. Politics is about I won this time, you won that time. It's not about putting all political differences aside and working together. Because my vision of what Europe should be doing may be different from your vision. Right now there are two great competing visions in Europe. They try to pretend they're not there, but there really is a difference between what Sarkozy wants and what Merkel wants. Sarkozy is closer to the Obama vision. Let's spend and spend and throw money at the problem, and when we get growth, we start taking care of the fiscal issue. But get people back to work and spending money, earning money, and moving the economy. Some people say that's the only way to do it. Paul Krugman, the Nobel Prize winner, says that's the only way to do it. And other economists say that's terrible. That's just digging yourself into a deeper hole. First, you have to get your fiscal house in order, reduce your budget deficit, and only when you do that can you start thinking about... And we know there's a big debate about that. In a democracy, I want to know that if there's elections to the European Parliament, there's a choice, I will vote If my side wins, I will see that as the policies of Europe. I don't get that. If I am a European in spirit, my children are European citizens, my parents are European, by some fluke of history, I'm not formally, but in spirit I'm European. If I were to vote, I don't think I would go and vote for the European Parliament. I would say, what difference does it make to me? So you and I have to agree to disagree. I hope you are right and I am wrong.
Hola, hola, buenas tardes. Bueno, voy a poner de pie para que se me vea. Chámame Carmen Méndez, son galega, europea. I'll try to speak in English. Sorry for the bad English, but I prefer it, Professor. First of all, congratulations.
Want to kiss me without a handkerchief, right?
okay. I'll try. thanks for your speech. I liked it very much. The thing I think rests overall in the underground is the risks. I mean, in my opinion, you forgot one element, the fear. It seems nowadays that European people are fed up of politicians, of politics, are tired. It is not a difference if I go to vote or I don't go. It doesn't make any difference. So I feed up. I give up. Do what you want. No matter. The element I think you forgot or you didn't want to speak about is the fear. The fear is one element which has in the past moved people, which has people to get awake, to look at. What do you think about fear nowadays? All those voices of new dictators who are, it's like a monster who is still sleeping, yes, but it sometimes we can see London youth recently. Sometimes it grows and says, hey, I'm here, look at me. If you don't go to vote, if you don't get interested in politics, maybe I wake up again. What do you think about that? Thank you very much.
When it comes to fear, I'm in the same camp as Roosevelt and Giovanni Paolo II. Roosevelt said, the only thing to fear is fear itself. And John Paul II said, be not afraid. We shouldn't have fear. We are in Europe. We belong to a great civilization. We are resourceful. We have countries with incredible human resources. So we should not be fearful, we should be decisive. We should not be, in Italian you say, rinunciatorio, to renounce. We should be Republican, take responsibility, hold people accountable. Fear is exactly what Roosevelt said. We should fear fear, but I just think that the human resources across Europe are so formidable, the civilizational resources across Europe are so formidable that it's very early days to fear. And I'm also not worried that we will return to totalitarian dictatorships, etc. That's just not even remotely, in my view, a viable option in any of our member states, and certainly not for the Union as a whole. So I see that there is some fear, but I don't see that it's so widespread. I see much more worrying than fear is indifference. Much more worrying than fear is I don't care. Much more worrying than fear is I can't make a difference. Those are the things that worry me. But fear, maybe I'm too Jewish. Fear is not part of my vocabulary.
Buenas tardes. Good evening, Professor. Do you believe that a European Parliament modeled after the bipartisan American Congress, with a House of Representatives representing the will of the majority and a Senate representing each member state, would gain legitimacy for this institution and get people interested in politics? Thank you.
No. Listen. We already have something like the American Congress. We have the European Parliament, which represents the people, so there are more members of Parliament from Germany than there are from Luxembourg, and that's like the House of Representatives or like the Bundestag. And then we have the Council of Ministers, in which there is equal, in which there's representation to member states. Also there's a weighted vote. But I'm not in love with the American model either. I mean, I don't think that the people of Rhode Island in the Senate, all 2.5 of them, should have the same weight as the people of California, 40 million of them. So I'm not sure that's such a good model. And the problem of Europe is much more profound than just some technical correction to the institutions of the European Union. It's really not that which is at the root of the problem, because otherwise Parliament already today could function as the Vox Populi. So I don't think the solution is going to be just let's change the configuration of the European Parliament. I don't see that that would make it operate markedly differently than today the Parliament and the Council of Ministers operate, which in some ways you could regard the Council of Ministers and the Parliament as a bicameral institution.
Sí, me gustaría plantear dos preguntas muy breves. Una es, en vista a la intervención militar en Libia por parte de franceses y británicos sobre todo, ¿cuál cree que son las capacidades en materia de seguridad o de intervención militar que tiene la Unión Europea actualmente? Aunque sé que se desvía un poco del tema de este discurso. Y el otro es, en una unión en la que coexisten diferentes niveles de gobierno, por ejemplo, aquí en España tenemos ayuntamientos, diputaciones, que son administraciones basadas en la provincia, autonomías, gobierno central y una Unión Europea por encima de todo ello, ¿cree que estos diferentes niveles son compatibles o, si la Unión Europea aumenta su poder, digamos, deberían de perder competencias y capacidad de acción? Gracias.
Do you mind if I only answer the first question and not the second one? It's a very good question, the second one, but it would require a whole new lecture, you know, multi-level governance theory and all that, and everybody's getting tired and hungry. But I will answer the first question. It's a very important question. And if you have the Spanish text of my lecture today, you will see that actually there's a big part that deals with Libya and security policy. The only reason I excluded it is because of time constraints, and I wanted to speak slowly, and I wanted to be understood. But I will say a word about it. We often say that the reason Europe does not have an authentic security policy is because security, the military, foreign policy is at the heart of national sovereignty. And governments are not willing to give up their sovereignty when it comes to issues of security, etc. Historically, that is wrong. And if you read the text, the translation of my paper into Spanish, I explain why historically. The plan for the European Defense Community was approved by all six governments. So the thesis, how could you have a European Defense Community that is too close to security, to sovereignty, it was approved by all six governments. It failed by a narrow majority in the French Parliament. And once it failed in the French Parliament, it was kicked out. Then something very bad happened in the history of Europe. Instead of saying, we have to try again, we cannot be a viable political community if we're not a viable defense community, Europe made a virtue of not having a defense policy. We are a civilian power. They tried to pretend that this was a good thing instead of realizing it was a failure and it was a bad thing. Why was it a bad thing? For two reasons. One, it left the field to the United States. So essentially Europe was saying, when it comes to all issues which involve the use of force, it has to be the United States. Now, I want to give you an example that hurts. The example that hurts is Bosnia and Kosovo. Because Europe needs a defense community not only to defend itself against threats. We can argue whether there are threats or there are no threats. But sometimes Europe needs force in order to show that it is serious about its values. Now, there is one thing that if you had asked any European in any member state at any moment in the history of Europe, they would say never. And that would be, never again will Europe allow a genocide of a religious minority to take place in Europe. That was one of the raison d'être, ragioni di essere, of the European integration. What happened in World War II could never ever happen again. Am I right or am I right? I'm right. And in Bosnia, a Muslim religious minority was genocided. In the heart of Europe, 500 kilometers from Rome, a genocide of a religious minority for one reason only, their religion. They were not criminals. It's because of their religion. Europe yapped and talked and talked and talked and allowed it to happen. Then, when a similar fate could have happened in Kosovo, Europe decided to act. And when they decided to act, they realized they couldn't act. They didn't have the means to act. They didn't have the capacity. I'll give you the numbers. So Italy provided an airfield. They were so proud. They provided an airfield. Not one single airplane, but an airfield. Spain provided 6 airplanes. Wow. They flew about 30 sorties. France flew about 400 sorties. Britain flew about 900 sorties. The United States flew 20,000 sorties. Without the Americans, Europe could not target, plan, execute to prevent a genocide happening a third time in the heart of Europe. That cannot be right. So I'm avoiding the discussions, the Soviet threat, the Iranians, etc. I'm talking about seriousness about our values. Libya, the same story. I supported the action in Libya. A horrible dictator for 40 years. A rebellion of people. Why wouldn't we in Europe support them? And then the same thing, it turns out. Without the Americans, we simply cannot do it. We simply cannot do it. We don't have the capacity. We don't have the materiel. We don't have the personnel. We don't have the munitions. We don't have the planning ability, etc. Here's the funny thing. When we look at all the money that is spent on defense in our individual member states, it's a huge amount. It's just spent dreadfully inefficiently because there is no European defense community. And then they say, ah, but that is too close to sovereignty. And I remind you, it's not so close to sovereignty because in 1954, they agreed to have a European defense community, all these governments. What has happened? We have lost the ability to think collectively about defense, to spend collectively about defense, to plan collectively about defense. And what's more, we've made a virtue of it. Why have we made a virtue of it? Because it's been comfortable for us. Because, now I'm going to tell you, young man, another thing that is very uncomfortable. I go back to Bosnia, Srebrenica. What was so awful about Srebrenica was that there was a contingent of Dutch soldiers there. I think they could have stopped it. If they couldn't have stopped it, they could have died trying to stop it. Noble death, wouldn't you say? Trying to prevent a genocide of a religious minority? If you're a soldier, why else are you a soldier? You're meant to risk your life. The Dutch soldiers stood and watched. It's not because they are Dutch. They could have been Italian or Spanish or German or French or British. It's not because they believed in what was happening was right. They were appalled. Like you and I, they believe in human rights. They thought what was happened was a crime against humanity. But they didn't act. You know why they didn't act? Because we've developed a culture that nothing is worth dying for and nothing is worth killing for. And if now and again we decide that something is worth dying for and something is worth killing for, we rent it out. We get other people to do the dying and killing for us. It's more comfortable. Then when we don't like what they're doing, we can accuse them, and when we need them, we can still call them. That is a terrible betrayal of the European ideal. So I was not going to talk about it, but you asked me a great question. The way to mobilize around a European defense community is not to invent an imaginary enemy. You know the story of 200 years ago. It's to say that we believe in certain values very deeply and that sometimes we have to go and help people who are oppressed, people who are killed because of their faith, because of their religion, because of their gender, because of the color of their skin. And sometimes that requires us to use force and even to sacrifice our life or to engage in the horrible business of using force. You know what? When we get to the situation that we can think about ourselves in that way, part of the problem of identity, which was discussed before, will be resolved. Because it's all very easy to talk about we all believe in human rights. But it really becomes a real identity when you don't only say it, but you do something about it. And in that area of defense, Bosnia, Libya, I can give you other example. Not a happy story.
Hola, buenas.
¿Alguna intervención más, por favor?
Sí, buenas tardes, doctor Weiler.
Quisiera hacer una pregunta corta y querría redundar sobre el concepto del mesianismo político. Esta Europa nuestra, de una Europa para el pueblo, pero sin el pueblo, ¿puede iniciar una nueva etapa sin la concepción de nación? Europa se ha armado una serie de mecanismos, de arquitecturas políticas, arquitecturas técnicas, pero que, como ha dicho usted, no cuentan con el bagaje de una clase política, o una concepción europeísta, sino que incluso en este momento de crisis vemos que hay una tendencia a un movimiento centrípedo, más que centrífugo, hacia los nacionalismos de cada Estado. Es constante en nuestra prensa actualmente con el tema de la crisis y respecto a la influencia de la política económica alemana, una tendencia a considerar un colonialismo por parte de Alemania. ¿Podemos llegar a superar esa concepción o está abocada Europa a, precisamente por esa tendencia a convertirse simplemente en una serie de poliarquitecturas políticas pero sin ningún tipo de entidad ni de unidad? Muchas gracias.
Can you repeat the question? No, just teasing. It's a tough question. No, I don't think Germany is acting colonially. Not at all. And I don't think that a noble vision for Europe depends on having a European nation, one European people. I always teach my students, I say, the originality of Europe, what makes it so special, what makes it different from every other federal experience in the political history of the West, is that it's not a vision of one people under God or without God, but of one people like we find in the United States, in Canada, in Australia, in Germany, in Austria. There's always the one people, the German people, the Austrians, the Canadians, the Australians, the Americans, etc. But that Europe's vision is encapsulated in the phrase an ever closer union among the peoples, plural, an ever closer union among the peoples of Europe. That's what's original about Europe. That's what is noble about Europe. That a Spaniard, can I say a Spaniard, or am I going to say, hey, there's no such thing, there's only Basques and Castilians and Andalusians and Catalans, etc. That a Spaniard or a Frenchman does not have to lose their French identity or their German identity or their Italian identity, and yet can feel part of a community of fate with Estonians and Lithuanians and Danes and Swedes and Portuguese, etc. It is possible. It is possible. We can call it not democracy, but demoicracy. Demoi, the plural of demos. A polity of multiple demoi, and yet where people feel a kind of commitment and responsibility and a shared fate. That's what we need. We're in this together. What happens to you as a Spaniard matters to me as a German, not simply because if you default, my banks will default, because I have a special attachment to you, because I think about you differently than I think about other peoples around the world. Other peoples around the world, my affinity to them is we all human beings, created in the image of God. But to you, the Spaniards or the Italians, etc., I have a special commitment because we are part of a community of fate. You see, you can already see the speech that I would give if I was a European politician. But I'm not. I'm a little professor, an academic. But that's how I conceptualize it. So I don't like the excuse, we don't have a people. That's what is special about Europe, that we preserve the identity of the various demoi. And that is what makes it so special, that I am able to have solidarity to people who I recognize are not me. That's been the success of Europe. And to preserve that, in some respects, the future of Europe will depend. So I don't like the gauche, clumsy, vulgar attempts to social engineer a European people, like the flag, the European anthem, the Ode to Joy, the passport with the same color. These are trivial. That is not what Europe is about, to try and pretend we are one people the way the Americans are one people, or the Germans are one people, or the Australians are one people. Our challenge is to say absolutely united in our diversity. Even though we're not one people, even though the Spaniards are Spaniards and the Germans are Germans and the Greeks are Greeks, we have a high level of commitment towards each other. We face the world together as a community of fate. That's, for me, the vision of Europe. Not a good answer, but the best I can give.
I would like to...
Is nobody going to ask me about Barcelona and Real Madrid now? You noticed that I didn't mention La Coruña. Not this year. I'm just such a soccer football fanatic. Back in my university, we have a weekly lunch to discuss the Liga every Monday.
I would like to ask the professor, I have a feeling that we are between the devil and the deep blue sea. On the one hand, we lack the perspective to understand that what we have done in Europe in 60 years, compared with the hundreds of years that took to create the nations of Europe, is amazing. On the other hand, I have a feeling that very often we are under the dictatorship of the politically correct, and we think that things don't cost, and the wishful thinking is enough to create Europe. I remember when there was a big debate about Turkey entering the European Union, and the political parties didn't dare, and nations didn't dare to say that it was a big issue, it has to be taken with care. And in France, all the political parties, except I remember Jean-Luc Mélenchon, a political from the left, which normally would have been expected to be very much for the integration of Turkey. He said, we have to be very careful because this has consequences, and we have to think of how this could hinder the construction of Europe. So don't we have to be a bit cautious about the consequences and be aware that everything costs, and don't forget that we are advancing at a tremendous pace, and we have to be optimistic therefore. Thank you.
I think you and I are more or less on the same wavelength, because on the one hand you're right. What has been constructed in Europe in 60 years is simply amazing. And some of the successes are not only amazing, even in the best dreams one could not imagine that it would be so successful. Really, World War II is a distant memory. It's not part of the reality. It's a success of Europe. And the common market is a remarkable reality. And Schengen is a remarkable reality. We cannot minimize that. We cannot shortchange ourselves. And at the same time, you are right that there's also... We paid a certain cost because we did, and we achieved these results, not often respecting how normal politics should be conducted. They were good results, but a benign dictatorship with many, many inverted commas, I don't mean that, but is still... So there was some price we paid for that. And what we see now is that we're not ready when things turn bad, because then the gap between political success and social solidarity suddenly emerges. And there is a measure of political correctness. You write about Turkey. Also, Valéry Giscard d'Estaing was very outspoken in saying, he was actually saying it should never happen. How could we imagine that the largest state in the European Union would be Turkey? My view on that, which I wrote about in my book, Un'Europa Cristiana, which exists also in Spanish. It exists in 9 languages except English. I wrote it in Italian. I said, we cannot say that the reason Turkey should not be a member state of the European Union is simply the fact that they are Muslim. That is not a good reason. But we can say there's a question of size, there's a question of political culture, there's a question, there are many other factors which can explain even enlargement should have been problematized a bit more. Above a certain size, it's difficult to have a democracy, because the specific gravity of every individual diminishes. So the relationship between size and democracy is understudied, but it's a very serious issue and has to be studied carefully. So I also agree with you. This is a good moment in Europe to speak truthfully and not with so much political correctness about a lot of issues, including that one. Thank you.
Bien, es la hora de cerrar y de clausurar esta conferencia. Así pues, muchas gracias a todos, en primer lugar, a todos los presentes por haber acudido a esta cita, a esta invitación. Espero, como director de la escuela, no haberles decepcionado. Gracias al señor consejero por acompañarnos y dedicar parte de su tiempo a esta conferencia. Muchas gracias, querido consejero. Y para el señor Weiler, on behalf of the Autonomous Galicia government, represented here by one of its members, as a director of this school for training civil servants, and on behalf, I think, of the audience and on my own, thank you, Professor Weiler. Thank you so much for your lecture, for your authority of your speech, for your admirable capability to describe and analyze the facts as they really are. Thank you to transmit us your acknowledgments and experiences on the study of the European integration with its faults, its deficits, but also, I think, with its aims. Well, you know, you always leave us with the sense to want, know more and more from you, talking with you. But this is impossible. I know this is at least for you an unhealthy wish. But let me to tell you that perhaps in not very far time, we will try to continue this interesting lecture with another inviting call addressing to you. Thank you very much. Thank you so much to stay with us once more. And thank you for your efforts to stay here with us. Thank you.
Se levanta la sesión.
Thank you very much. A wonderful lecture.
Thank you.